Powering.
Turn on.
Online.
Download.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski with you this afternoon here on RN. Welcome to Weekend Arts. What makes an artist? Formal training and membership of the art world? Or something more personal, more idiosyncratic? Stan Hopewell never went to art school and made paintings for a period of just 4 years in his 70s. His subjects were resolutely unfashionable in art world terms, his long and happy marriage and his love of God. So why has one of Australia's leading art critics written a book about Stan's art? Find out later this hour. And you'd remember the debate, well, more of a disagreement really, over the so-called black armband view of history here. Well, how a nation should treat a brutal past is not, of course, a problem unique to us. The changing ways that Spain has remembered its civil war and the Franco dictatorship is something we'll also be looking at this hour. In Spain, it's been a remembering led by filmmakers and writers, and not the ones you might expect. But let's start today with Chris Sains, who 6 months ago took over as director of one of Australia's most visited art museums, Quag Gomer in Brisbane. Welcome to Weekend Arts, Chris.
Thanks very much, Sarah.
So, Chris, one of the themes that you've returned to since taking on the role of the director is the fact that museums need to find a balance between their permanent collection and their temporary exhibitions, which are, of course, often what bring in ticket sales. What do you think the best way to strike this balance is?
Well, I think it's a balance that every art museum and museum tries to strike for itself. And I guess what I've endeavoured to do in the statement I made earlier this week is to bring a little bit of that balance back to putting more of the collection out into play and including GOMA as a more permanent space for collection displays, which it's not been since it opened in 2006. So just one little element is, rather than having the serendipity of an Indigenous Australian art show that might change out, or the big mega show that was just closed a week ago, the My Country exhibition, we're going to place a permanent collection of changing but permanent collection of Indigenous Australian art, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, in Gallery 2, right at the front of the QAG. So that's an example of something that we haven't made quite that level of commitment to previously.
And is budget realities part of the thinking around that? I mean, imagine it makes more sense financially for a gallery to make use of its holdings.
Absolutely. I wouldn't deny that for one moment. In fact, when you look to GOMA, it's a very high cost churn that goes on throughout that institution. And it's true that some exhibitions, like My Country, will last for 5 or 6 months. But at the same time, when you're also changing exhibitions around on level 3, which might have a duration of 4 or 5 months, and you're doing quite a number of those in a year, perhaps 10 or 12, if you can slow that churn just by 3 or 4 shows, you're actually putting more resource back into the basket, as it were, to enable you to put more investment into bigger temporary exhibitions. So yes, that's certainly part of the strategy.
Perhaps Quag Gomer's most significant contribution, not just nationally but internationally, has been the Asia Pacific Triennial, now 20 years old. How are you imagining its future?
I'm imagining it as a future that we want to build on and sustain, because I think that being someone who was there at, as it were, the birth of the APT back in 1993 when I was first working at the gallery, what we want to do this time is, I guess, change a few things around. We want, first of all, to introduce a couple of new countries, which we've not yet announced, but which we've certainly got on our radar, and we'll be going to travel to those places in the coming months. We're going to reintroduce the academic symposium that was a very central part of the first few triennials, but then kind of fell out of favour or just simply disappeared for whatever reason, as things do. So we're reintroducing that and working, hopefully, with all of the three Brisbane-based universities to get that out of the ground and make it a central plank again of the triennial proposition. And as well as that, we're also making performance a bigger and more continuing part of the triennial. Often, the triennial opening weekend has the most amazing festival of cultural and artistic performance. But what happens in month 2 and month 3? 3 and month 4. There's often less of it, except for a few public program highlights. And we're looking too at bringing more younger and emergent artists into the triennial frame as a kind of conscious effort this time round. So they're some of the changes we're thinking of.
Chris, I'm just back from the Setoichi Art Triennial in Japan, and Chris is just having a... You can have a glass of water, Chris, while you're listening to me. That's fine. At the island of Naoshima, I was blown away by the work of American artist James Turrell, and was very excited to see that he's on your list for upcoming shows at GOMA.
Yes, he is. It won't
quite
be
a coup.
It won't be a solo show. In fact, there is one of those happening at the end of next year at the National Gallery of Australia. In fact, it's a variant, I think, of the exhibition currently at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. But the show that we're conceiving, which has got a working title of Light, but it's a kind of big enough and broad enough one probably to stick, we're inviting James Turrell and artists like Jenny Holzer to Brisbane. We're commissioning new work from them, and we're very much following in the track of some of the shows that the gallery's done tremendously successfully in recent times. And I'd cite the 21st Century exhibition as the kind of exhibition that we're talking about, albeit in this case there will be work which we're borrowing, not work that we entirely own. But I think Turrell is a master artist. I saw the recent exhibition at the Guggenheim and the one in LA.
I'm very jealous
of
that, Chris.
I've always been a fan, but I'm a bigger one now. I even immersed myself in what Turrell calls his spheres. And in effect, what you do is you lie down flat on a kind of sliding board. You're slid by lab-coated assistants inside this fiberglass sphere, and then all light and all sound is shut out, and you are immersed in the most visceral and at times quite disturbing lightscape.
Right.
And also there's a kind of audio dimension to it. I wasn't aware, actually, that Turrell used sound to the extent that he does, and I came out of it feeling a little bit woozy, but really happy. It was an amazing sensation.
What could you ask for an artwork, Chris Sainz, in that? Your predecessor at Craig GOMA, Tony Elwood, made a great pitch for the institution as a family-friendly space.
Yeah.
I mean, he got some criticism for that as people sort of fought their way past the prams to the artworks. Are you as keen on kids as Tony was, Chris?
Just as. And I think that Tony did do a fantastic job, in particular, of raising up the Children's Arts Centre from its kind of foundations at GOMA into really a world-leading institution in terms of the presentation and production of artist-based projects that are for and about children. And what I'm proposing to do at QAG, which is a building I think that needs a little bit more love than it might have received in recent years, is to open up part of it on the Watermall space into a learning centre. And we're looking to a number of American and North American museums, and also, of course, to places like Tate Modern, to develop a concept of learning which is about both applied and practical, as well as, if you like, virtual and digital. So it'll be a space for all ages, not just for those that happen to have the company of children when they come to the gallery. But yes, so that, if you like, for me is a kind of complementary outgrowth that's emerging from the great success that the Children's Arts Centre established.
Chris, Craig GOMA enjoyed a close relationship with Queensland's state Labor government. How are your coffers faring under Premier Campbell Newman?
Well, I don't think it's anything to do with our relationship. In fact, before I took this post on, you might say the budgetary die was cast. And it's true that particularly since the fifth anniversary of GOMA, and in years prior, the government was giving, you know, $2 and $3 million top-ups to the gallery to enable it to present an amazing flotilla of international blockbusters that the gallery presented highly successfully. I will run out, if you will, of that special kitty at the end of this current financial year. But I guess what we're doing is trying to build a strong, robust relationship with government, which I believe we've already made a great start doing, myself and the chair of the board. And what we'd like to do is believe that when we develop great ideas, the government will back them. And I truly think that's what will occur in years out. But for the moment, we're having to deal with a slightly more constrained budget setting. But, hey, I come from Auckland. I'm used to that. We'll make it work.
Chris Sainz, Director of Craig GOMA, many thanks for coming in to Weekend Arts this afternoon.
Great pleasure.
I'm Sarah Kanoski. The Week in Movies with Jason DeRosso next.
If there's a song for every moment of our life, what would My Life as a Playlist sound like? Curate the soundtrack to your life and be involved with this fascinating study about music and emotions. Birthdays, childhood, love and heartbreak, weddings and funerals. How do you mark your milestones with music? Get involved. Find the link for My Life as a Playlist at the RN homepage.
On the final cut this week, Naomi Watts is Diana, Princess of Wales, falling in love with a Pakistani heart surgeon. Plus, we'll meet the young director who's remade the 1978 Ozploitation horror classic, Patrick. And a heads up on the Adelaide Film Festival starting this week. But first, Diana.
What do I look like? One minute everyone's pointing at me because I'm sleeping with the Princess of Wales. Next thing she denies it all and I'm the hospital joke.
Just trying to protect you.
Protect?
Well, I knew you'd be upset. That's why we rubbished the story.
Rubbish? Yes, good choice of word. That's exactly what I felt like.
You can't object to being on the front pages and then complain when I protect you from looking like Casanova.
You've blown our cover.
Well, it can be dealt with. I'm good at handling the press.
Oh, magnificent.
Now I'm clear on what you want.
How could it not have been clear? I am a surgeon. I can't work with the paparazzi sticking their cameras in my face.
Loosely based on the real-life romance between the Princess of Wales and a British Pakistani heart surgeon named Hasnat Khan, Diana is a film that attempts to explain how a shy, fragile woman spat out by the well-oiled PR machine of Buckingham Palace fought back. It's also a story of how she lost the love of her life to the pressures of public life. Naomi Watts doing her best with the accent and mimicking Diana's habit of peering up sheepishly from beneath her fringe, delivers a performance that's close but no cigar. She lacks that gauntness Diana had in her final years and never quite manages to express a vulnerability in the role. Naveen Andrews, who some will recognise from The English Patient and others from TV's Lost, is, by comparison, not bad as the Doctor. He embodies a kind of sexy paradox, a man of science with a traditionalist streak when it comes to family and religion, who's also in love with fast food and cool jazz. He tells Diana he follows no one and encourages her to be more spontaneous, to improvise, like his favourite musicians. Corny as this sounds, it's as good advice as any. And sucking on a cigarette at London's jazz club Ronnie Scott's on their first date, you feel his allure. The ensuing romance is full of cat-and-mouse attempts to dodge the paparazzi, hiding in cars, wearing wigs. It's almost fun in a camp kind of way, though Oliver Hirschbiegel isn't that kind of director. He's the man who made that other film about the last days of an iconic figure, Downfall, the one where Bruno Ganz played Hitler. Another bad casting decision, come to think of it. Perhaps a more straightforward subject, though. Here, his film never quite knows how to deal with certain uncomfortable truths. Early on, the princess exits the hospital where Khan works and rebukes a paparazzi for taking her picture, telling him she's just been spending the night comforting terminally ill patients. We know she's been on a late-night visit to her lover trying to rustle up a bit of affection. A pretty terrible lie, if you think about it. It's one of several moments in the film that present Diana as a cynical manipulator, pampered in a world where servants are like girlfriends and a personal acupuncture therapist gives amazing big sisterly advice. It's a pity the film can't wrangle more tragedy from the dysfunctional elements in Diana's life, her battle with Buck Palace over custody of her two sons, the ill-fated trip to visit Khan's family in Pakistan that fails to win over the prospective mother-in-law, an episode the real Khan has denied ever happened. Then there's the desperate last-ditch attempt to win Khan back by making him jealous with Dodi Al-Fayed. And yet somehow it's still the image of a privileged, self-centred woman that prevails through all of it. Cue Diana in Bosnia on one of her landmine awareness-raising missions. She sees a peasant woman grieving at her son's grave and stops the convoy to give her a hug. She's improvising, just like Khan told her. One of her entourage takes out his camera and captures the embrace for the papers. Diana is well aware she's in full people's princess mode, and you feel like telling the poor peasant woman to run from the vampire. Maybe the trouble with this film is that it wants to stretch Diana in too many different directions. celebrity icon, earth mother, sex symbol, scorned woman. I don't think the real Diana was even half of all that. Well, who could be? This film certainly fails to convince us. Diana is out now and rated M. On our end, we're talking film on The Final Cut.
Patrick, this might sting a bit.
What did you say?
Oh, nothing, Doctor. I was just talking to him, I suppose.
What were you discussing?
Doctor, are you absolutely certain that he isn't aware of us?
Nurse Jarkard, I've monitored him for 24 hours a day with an EEG that registers every kind of brainwave from a fart to a nervous breakdown. What do you suppose it has registered?
I don't know, Doctor.
Just farts.
Now to director Mark Hartley and the remake of Patrick. Hartley, you might remember, made a documentary a few years ago about the glory years of Ausploitation cinema called Not Quite Hollywood, which helped get a conversation started in the Australian film industry about why we turned our noses up at the sexy, often brutal and sometimes proudly distasteful genre films we once made and exported with some success to the world. Patrick was one of these titles back in 1978, a film about a killer in a coma satisfying his sexual and homicidal urges via telekinetic powers from his hospital bed. Hot young nurses, sinister scientists, and lots of sudden edge-of-your-seat scares. It went on to become a cult classic. Hartley's remake ramps up the mood with a more gothic production design, faster editing and campier sexual innuendo. And his cast shine. Rachel Griffiths takes on Julia Blake's matron role. Charles Dance is the head doctor, who was played by Robert Helpman in the original. And Shani Vincent, who's becoming a real star of genre cinema, is the nurse who attracts Patrick's attention. You can't fault them, but the question remains, why remake such a classic? Mark Hartley.
It's interesting. I don't think that all films should be remade. Some should be just left alone. But Patrick, to me, it had such a great central premise that it could be expanded upon. And the original film, even though I really loved it when I was a kid, when you see it now, it is very much of its time. It's very much a film rooted in 1978. And I just thought it had such a great central premise, which is here's a guy with unlimited powers, but with very limited ambitions, that all he wants to do is use these incredible powers to make someone fall in love with him. I thought, that's a great idea. People, when they heard, oh, you're remaking Patrick, they all thought it was going to be a high-tech, born identity with a guy in a coma. And that was the last thing we wanted to do. We actually wanted to even make it more of a throwback than the original film.
No, well, there's a lovely gothic mood to it. There's a dark palette that you're using. I mean, explain to us a little bit about the whole philosophy behind the production design.
What's interesting, the original is all very much set in broad daylight in an inner city hospital room, and we thought that we really wanted to make a film that was an old school gothic chiller. That was where we kind of started with this, and it was all about bringing an atmosphere to this story that the original didn't have. And the way to do that, we just thought, was by setting it down in an old convent, making it a very seaside locale, which has always worked in films like The Birds and The Fog, and making you not quite sure what time frame it's set in.
How did you update it, though? I mean, even though there is this slightly retro aspect throughout the whole thing, which actually suits it, but what were you thinking about when you were, you know, working on it with your friend and writer, Justin King? What were you thinking about needing to bring to this story?
Well, we liked the idea that modern technology had taken away a lot of privacy. You know, anyone can find out anything about anyone now that you possibly couldn't have 10 years ago. So we thought that's the way that Patrick can utilize modern day, you know, technology. We didn't go overboard, but he does text now. He uses a computer, but the computer still looks like it's 15 years old sitting there in the...
Yes, that's right. And he looks up various, what I don't think you were able to use the actual Facebook template in the film, but there's something to the equivalent of that.
I think he uses up YouSearch. Yes.
That's
which
right. Finds out all about this sexy young nurse that's working there, Shani Vincent. Amazing, she's become quite a star in genre films at the moment.
Well, it's interesting. She had some kind of profile because she'd been the lead in Step Up 3D and
as a dancer,
Blue Crush 2, prior to Patrick, she'd made a film called You're Next, which was a huge hit at Toronto, and Lionsgate bought it for the world, sat on it for a year, and recently released it in the States and here.
A slasher flick,
and she's now considered, you know, kind of the next go-to girl for those kinds of film roles.
I want to talk a little bit about the genre filmmaking more generally, because, of course, you 5 years ago now made that documentary, Not Quite Hollywood, which kind of within what was a burgeoning debate around the place of genre filmmaking in Australia at the time, took a kind of advocate position and sort of said, along with many other people, that genre filmmaking, for want of a better term, had been unjustly dismissed by our filmmaking establishment and so forth. 5 years on from that debate, have we seen genre filmmaking, though, you think, step up? Because I struggle to think of genre films that have broken through at the box office that we've made locally. But are you more optimistic?
No, not at all. I think that there's a big problem with genre film in Australia, and that is just that audiences don't embrace it. But it's not just Australian genre films they don't embrace in Australia. They don't embrace any kinds of genre films, really. You can look at films like The Purge, which is the number one box office film in America, going straight to DVD here. Films like Evil Dead, films like Cabin in the Woods, getting very, very limited releases here.
Ah, so it's a question, all right, of local taste.
It's being kind of different from audiences, yeah, not embracing genre films in Australia, thinking that they're either...
What's that down to?
Well, look... As opposed to America, I guess we don't have blacks and Latinos here. We don't have college towns. That could be part of it. It's just that Australian audiences never really flocked to those films. Even in the 70s, they weren't. There's always been breakouts like Mad Max, Wolf Creek, etc., but they're very few and far in between. And it's a trouble trying to make genre films in Australia because you need to get a local distributor to come on board. And local distributors are gun-shy because they know that the audiences don't really embrace these films in Australia.
The other thing that strikes you about this film is that it's wall-to-wall lush orchestral music. Tell me about the composer, because you had a bit of a coup here.
We were incredibly lucky. We were blessed to be able to recruit an Italian composer called Pino Donaggio, who had been a pop singer back in the 50s, had written "You Don't Have to Say You Love Me," which had obviously been a gigantic
hit. I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah. Had recorded it. And then it obviously got reworked by lots of people.
Laughing his way to the bank ever since.
That's true. Mm. But Pino then went into composing film scores and did Don't Look Now for Nicholas Rogue, did a lot of early Brian De Palma films, Dressed to Kill, Carrie, and even did films for Joe Dante, did The Howling and Piranha. So all the way through through the pre-production on Patrick, I was just listening to Constant Donaggio. And... we managed to track down an email address for him and sent him an email. And miraculously, he really loved the rough cut and came on board and recorded a fantastic score. He recorded it with in Prague with the City of Prague Symphony Orchestra, or the National Czech Orchestra. And like you said, if you've got a Donaggio score, you don't bury it. You have it loud and lush. And I think there's 80 minutes of music in this 95-minute film.
Director Mark Hartley. Patrick, the remake, releases next week. And here's a confession, I wasn't a huge fan of the original. This doesn't win me over completely, but it has its moments. It's screening at the drive-in during the Adelaide Film Festival at the weekend, and I reckon it'd be great fun there. Speaking of the Adelaide Film Festival, I've been browsing the program and there are some must-see movies hot from the international festival circuit, including Claire Denis' Bastards and Zha Zheng Ke's A Touch of Sin. There's a retrospective on New York indie director Shirley Clarke, who made films about the jazz underground, the gay scene and the avant-garde back in the 60s, long before the white middle class got hip. And there's also a clutch of films financed by the festival itself, from the likes of Warwick Thornton, Rolf de Heer, and John Curran, of course, with his film Tracks that premiered recently in Venice. It's going to be a great few days. I'll be in town over the weekend presenting a batch of short films, including one I directed, and checking out as much as I can.
So are you saying that to say what?
I'm saying it's only because you're hearing it.
No, you're saying something. And if you're saying it, I'm hearing it because you're saying it. What are you saying? Let it be said.
Well, I think you're playing me.
Are you want to be played?
I've been at your hip for 10 months, but after this, I think maybe you're playing me.
If you're not able to be in Adelaide, one of your other options in wide release around the country this week is a film called Two Guns, an action comedy starring Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington, adapted from a graphic novel by Stephen Grant. A couple of maverick law enforcers, one working for Navy intelligence, the other a narc, have gone undercover to bust open a Mexican drug cartel. Funny though, neither of them realise they're both on the same side. Clearly their bosses didn't talk. This is the kind of film where convoluted plot lines about who's on whose side and who's killed or who's sleeping with who almost, but not quite, hide the fact that, boiled down to its essence, the script has next to zero complexity. The action isn't much to write home about either, though the tough guy banter between these two as they philosophise about donuts and women, Tarantino has a lot to answer for, is occasionally amusing. Washington and Wahlberg are a watchable duo even with this mediocre material. Two Guns is rated MA. I'm Jason DeRosso. This has been The Final Cut. Remember to check the site for transcripts or to leave comments. I'll see you on Twitter at JDRRR or next week here on RN.
Weekend Arts on RN this Saturday afternoon. I'm Sarah Kanoski. A few weeks ago on The Final Cut, Jason DeRosso looked at Pedro Almodovar's new madcap airplane film, I'm So Excited. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm excited about seeing it. In the Anglophone world, we tend to see Almodovar's films as these riots of, you know, hedonistic pleasure. But this work and that of other Spanish artists actually tells us a lot about the traumas that Spain endured in the 20th century. It's estimated that 200,000 civilians lost their lives during the Spanish Civil War. One of those was the great poet and playwright Federico García Lorca. What happened to both Lorca's physical body and his body of work during Franco's dictatorship, and then after the return to democracy, reveals much about how Spanish culture has dealt with this violent period in its history. Maria Delgado is Professor of Theatre and Screen Arts at Queen Mary, University of London. Maria, listeners might be shocked by the scale of civilian deaths in the Spanish Civil War. Franco's not usually put in the same category of evil as those other 20th century dictators, Hitler or Stalin. Why is that?
Franco was a very clever man, and he had a group of very savvy political advisers. We tend to think of spin doctors as a very 21st century phenomenon, but Franco had his own spin doctors who worked with him to make sure that his image was never that of the angry, vicious, fear-inducing dictator. Quite the opposite. He largely presented himself as a benign, in the first instance, father figure and then grandfatherly figure. If you think about the Spanish tourist industry, and of course Spain in the 60s, reinvented itself as the desirable tourist location for Europe, he used pictures of himself with his grandchildren on the beach like a normal grandfather figure to sell Spain as a safe place to come and visit, as a friendly place to come and visit. You know, from the very beginning, he sought to distance himself from that culture of the tough dictator. Quite the opposite. He was a kind of a warm patriot figure. And that's one of the reasons I think that the world outside Spain finds it problematic to think of him as a dictator who was responsible for a regime of terror. But that's actually what happened in Spain.
And tell me, Maria, about your own family history's involvement in the Civil War, because you have parents who come from opposite sides of
Absolutely.
This battle.
Yeah, my father's family were refugees from the Basque Country. In 1937, 2,000 Basque children were evacuated for humanitarian reasons. Some of them came to Britain and some of them went to Russia. My father had to stay in England at the end of the Civil War because his father was killed. His father was one of the Republican casualties during the Civil War. A lot of his uncles also died, not just in the Civil War, but in Franco prisons. At the end of the Civil War, there were about 370,000 prisoners. And my mother came from the rebel side.
The Francoist side.
They called themselves nationalists. It was one of the ways in which they promoted this image of themselves as being the party of Spain, if you like. And my mother came from a right-wing family, and she was one of the economic migrants who left Spain in the 1950s in search of employment. She was a nurse and came to London in search of work. She came from a very different kind of family. And growing up, I always found it extraordinary that my father's family would never talk about civil war, partly because Franco established a culture of fear. People wouldn't talk about it because they'd seen too many of their relatives, too many friends, too many people they knew who'd been taken away in the middle of the night, who'd been shot without any kind of judicial hearing. And so people from the left just didn't talk about what had happened. And I always found it very strange that my mother's family could mourn their dead, even though there'd been a far smaller percentage of them. And my father's family never could mourn their dead. They wouldn't even talk about it. My grandmother wouldn't even mention the Civil Civil War, wouldn't even mention the regime of terror, wouldn't talk about how many of her own family had been killed. It was something that you didn't talk about because you were too scared.
And Federico García Lorca was one of those civilians who was killed, and he was killed in August 1936, which was only 1 month after war broke out in Spain. Why was Lorca a target?
Lorca was associated with centre-left causes. He, in fact, led a state-sponsored theatre company, a state-funded theatre company called La Barraca, The Hut, which took Spanish classical plays from the 17th century around the villages of Spain, part of the kind of education programme. He promoted the building of libraries and, in fact, opened the library in his own town of Fuente Vaqueros in the 1930s. So he was very much associated with progressive causes. And so he was a target. Granada was essentially a right-wing city. His family were known to be left-wing. Lorca was arrested and he was killed probably on the night of the 18th of August. He was shot at dawn by a firing squad.
Which was a common procedure for civilians who were killed during this time.
Common. The area where he was killed, Viznar, which is to the northeast of Granada, they calculate that over 2,000 Republican civilians were shot in extrajudicial executions in the period immediately after the outbreak of the Spanish Civil War. Federico García Lorca was one of those early casualties. Mm. And of course, he served because he was a well-known writer, poet, and a dramatist. He mobilized international attention.
And partly because of that, the Franco regime sort of wanted to disassociate itself then from Lorca's murder.
Very much so. One of the things that you begin to realize is the way in which they realized that this was really bad publicity for the regime. From a very early stage, they sought to promote this as a mistake, if you like, something that had happened without being endorsed by the nationalists. You know, even in 1940, when a death certificate was issued for Lorca, the death certificate said he died of war wounds, which suggests he'd been, you know, shot by a stray bullet or something like that. Well, actually, this was not the case. The case was that he was assassinated.
This is Weekend Arts on ABCRN. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and I'm speaking with Maria Delgado, professor from the University of London. Maria, so after the end of Franco's regime and the sort of transition to democracy, the focus became very much on the future and on leaving this sort of torturous past behind. So where it might have been that families who'd suffered losses like your own in the Civil War at first didn't want to talk about it because they were fearful of reprisals, then there is this shift where they don't want to talk about that past because they want to move on. They want to look to a new Spain. So what happened to Lorca during that period, or Lorca's memory and Lorca's works in Spain?
Well, really in the transition to democracy, the decision was made in 1977 to have an amnesty law. So even before the Spanish constitution came into being, it was decided that an amnesty law would ensure that no one could be prosecuted for the crimes of the Franco, also for terrorist crimes committed during that time. And I think one of the things that Spain wanted to do was to look forward, to incorporate themselves within the structures of Europe. And so you had movements like the Movida, of course, encapsulated in the early films of Pedro Almodóvar, which was about hedonism. It was about pleasure. It was about looking to the future. And so Spain, in effect, forgot about its past. And what we talk about now is the Pact of Amnesia, or the Pact of Forgetting, or the Pact of Silence, which is about, you know, let's just put that, let's sweep that under the carpet and let's look forward. And Spain did indeed look forward. They hosted the Olympics in 1992. Madrid was City of Culture. They had the Seville Expo. So it was about Spain reinventing itself as the new member state of Europe. And, it, you know, people look to Spain. They love Spain's creative energy in art, in film, in theatre. So Spain became the kind of it place. But eventually those ghosts, and we're talking about over 100,000 individuals like Lorca, shot or killed in extrajudicial executions, who lie in mass graves around the country, those ghosts came back to haunt the nation. So what you had was, you know, a series of kind of films, novels, theatre works, artworks in the late 1990s that really began to probe this issue of historical memory. And Lorca became in many ways ways the kind of public face of the disappeared in Spain. His works were staged. They weren't staged during the Franco era, or very few of them were staged during the Franco era. But in the aftermath of Franco's death, you had a kind of, you know, re-evaluation of Lorca. You also had a political appropriation of Lorca. So even the right, and José María Aznar, the right-wing prime minister of Spain in the late 90s and early 20th century, appropriated Lorca.
He became a national figure, an emblem of Spain's literary greatness.
Exactly, a national icon. And Aznar was about forgetting the specific conditions that had led to his death. So it's like, let's not look to the circumstances around Lorca's death. Let's just say his poetry has no political affiliation. And we all know that's a problematic idea. And it really became in the 21st century that the historical associations that had been set up in Spain began to probe the idea of looking into the past. The recovery of historical memory came into being in 2002 and began to look into the issue of the exhumation of these mass graves. And of course, in 2007, Spain introduced a law of historical memory, which meant that you could ask for state funds to assist you in the recovery of your dead. And there have been a number of really high-profile openings of mass graves. And of course, in 2009, Lorca's grave was opened.
But unsuccessfully.
Well, successfully in terms of it was open, but unsuccessfully in the sense of the fact that his body was not there. And of course, it remains one of the great mysteries of the early 20th century. Where are Lorca's remains?
Maria, you mentioned the work of filmmaker Pedro Almodovar, and in a way it seems that the way his career has shifted almost mirrors this transformation in Spain from wanting to focus on the future to a willingness to look at the past.
Yes, I think one of the things about early Almodovar is that he was categorised as an apolitical filmmaker. I mean, I think actually his work was deeply political from the very beginning, but he was seen to embody the kind of pleasure principle, if you like, of that early hedonism.
Which, of course, coming out of a dictatorship is immensely political.
Completely political. You're absolutely right, Sarah. But I think there's been a shift in the 21st century, and I think that Almodovar has really embraced issues of historical memory. You only need to look at films like Volver, where the ghost of the mother is thought to have come back to life, to see the kind of presence of the dead among the living. Also, Broken Embraces, The Skin I Live In. Even his new film, I'm So Excited, also handles issues of historical memory and the pact of silence. Even though in many ways this has been seen as a film that returned to the hedonism of his early years, I would argue that it's a film that's very deeply embedded in 21st century Spain, in a Spain in crisis, but it provides a very idiosyncratic response to that crisis.
Of course it does. It's Almodovar film. How could it not be idiosyncratic? That's part of the delight, isn't it? And of course, these debates and investigations into historical memory are happening within the context of Spain's economic crisis. I think there's statistics of something like 22 to 23% unemployment. Nearly half of Spain's young are unemployed.
Yes, I mean, the issue of Spain's crisis, of course, has perturbed a lot of artists. And Almodovar, his most recent film, I'm So Excited, actually deals with the crisis of these white elephant airports that were built and are now unused. There are 17 unused airports in Spain, and he actually films part of I'm So Excited in one of them, the airport of Ciudad Real, which is 150 kilometres south of Madrid, which only operated for 3 years.
It's got,
I think, the biggest runway, the longest runway in Spain, and it was closed because it just wasn't sustainable. And artists like Almodovar have dealt with this. I think it's not a coincidence that a lot of the films that have secured international distribution have been films that deal with horror, that deal with zombies, that deal with the living dead. If you think about films like The Orphanage by Bayona.
Don't make me think about that film. I still have nightmares about that film.
Yeah, and the films of Guillermo del Toro,
indeed,
of course, Pan's Labyrinth, which are in many ways about the ways in which the dead haunt the living. So I would argue that culture has actually played a really important role in Spain in serving as the conscience of the nation.
Right.
Try to think about the ways we think about the past in Spain. How can we articulate a more nuanced and a more focused understanding of the past that isn't simply about the left was right, the right was wrong. How can we think in more complex ways about the ways in which mismemory and history have been constructed in Spain? Mm.
Maria Delgado, this is a fascinating subject. Thanks so much for being my guest on Weekend Arts.
Pleasure. Thank you, Sarah.
And Maria Delgado is Professor of Theatre and Screen Arts at Queen Mary University of London. And she was visiting Australia for a lecture on Lorca and historical memory at the University of Queensland.
This week on All in the Mind, the healing power of music.
Some of the standout moments have been working with people who might be coming out of a coma and not verbal at all, and then having that moment in therapy when you're singing and they'll suddenly come out with a word.
Then catch the Philosopher's Zone. This week, solitary confinement as a philosophical problem.
Philosophers haven't engaged with these issues, even as an ethical issue.
All in the Mind, followed by the Philosopher's Zone.
5 to 6 this Sunday on RN.
At the moment on RN this Saturday afternoon, you're with Weekend Arts. I'm Sarah Konoski. Great to have your company. We're about to head to Western Australia to hear about a very interesting outsider artist. Or, well, is that the right description to use? We're going to ask Ted Snell about that. But let's hear some music from Perth. This is Carl Smith. He used to be in the band SodaStream, but this is a song from his new album, Kites.
I want you, yeah, I want you. In dreams and out in the sunlight, in line at the supermarket check-in, and under lights without green really moving.
That's Carl Smith from Perth originally, though I think he might be inhabitant of Melbourne at the moment. And that's the song I Want You from his new album called Kites. You're with Weekend Arts on RN. I'm Sarah Konoski. Well, what do you think makes an artist? Is it someone immersed in the theory and history of art and the whole machinery of the modern art market? Or is it someone compelled to paint for themselves for more personal reasons? Stan Hopewell falls squarely into the latter category, and he's the focus of a new book called Facing the Stars by Professor Ted Snell from the University of Western Australia. Welcome back to Weekend Arts, Ted.
Ah, thank you, Sarah. Nice to be here.
So let's start with Stan Hopewell. Tell me who Stan is and how he started to paint.
Well, he's a lovely man who's had a very, and up until a tragic time in his life when his wife became very ill, a fairly uneventful life. But then Joyce became extremely ill, and Stan had to look after her. He was in his early 80s at this point. And while Joyce got worse and worse, and Stan had to look after her more and more, he found solace in writing every day and also in making paintings. Well, first of all, in fact, he didn't make paintings. He framed his wife Joyce's paintings because Joyce was an amateur artist. But then as Joyce got a little bit less able to sort of distinguish what was happening around her, he started to change her paintings, improve her paintings, and then use her paints to make his own incredible images that were sort of an amalgam of his life, his love for Joyce, his love for his family, his love for Australia, his war experiences, his Freemasonry, pretty much everything that had happened in his life all of a sudden came together in this amazing amalgam of images.
To start painting in your 80s, that's an impressive, new stage of one's life. But before we focus on his artwork, tell me a bit more about Stan's, as you put it, ordinary life, if anyone has such a thing, because it was full of some pretty extraordinary experiences. As you mentioned, he was in World War II.
Well, that's right. And I think it's a good thing to note that, in fact, everybody's humdrum ordinary life is, in fact, extraordinary if you look at it from a different perspective. Stan, like so many kids, was brought up in the Depression. Fortunately for Stan, he was living close to Cottesloe Beach, so he joined the Life Saving Club. He was able to go to the beach every day. As Geoffrey Bolton said, it's a fine country to starve in, in the Depression. And it was for Stan. Then he started to learn how to become an electrician. When the war came, he joined the Air Force. He went over to England, where he was working on the bombers. He was sent to the Near East. He had some horrendous experiences there, saw dreadful things happening to friends and to colleagues. Came back, then went back to England, was working on the bombers that went out every night, and of course some didn't come back. Must have been absolutely traumatic for a sort of young 20-year-old. He married Joyce.
He met her in England, didn't he?
He did. Yeah, she was also in the Air Force. He came back to Australia. Things were tough. He had to find a job. He had to find a house. He had to work through the bureaucracy to get Joyce to Australia. But eventually they did come to Australia. They started a family. Stan worked for a number of people as an electrician, including Alan Bond and Lang Hancock. So he was right there in the middle.
Did they pay their bills? Maybe that's why Stan had to turn to art, Ted.
Sad point. In fact, they didn't.
Oh, really? Well,
he did have trouble with his business. But eventually, you know. But there's another nice story too, because he and Joyce one day went to the beach and the governor, Sir Charles Gardner, was there. He had a bad leg, went for a swim, got caught in a rip, and Joyce pulled him free. So there you are. You know, it's just all these amazing stories that make, as you say, a fairly uneventful life really interesting.
And then, so as you say, it's when his wife, they ended up being married for something like 62 years. This is a pretty remarkable feat in itself. And Joyce had breast cancer and then Alzheimer's. And so when you've spoken to Stan, what was it that made him want to start painting for someone who's never chosen that means of communication or expression? Does he have a sense about why he wanted to pick up a paintbrush?
Look, I think this is one of the most interesting things about the whole project, and it certainly was for me, in where does that creative urge come from? Where does that spark that all of a sudden ignites this need to make sense of the world, to represent it, and to make it available to others? Look, to be honest, I don't think Stan knew. He started painting. As he was moving the paint around, things happened. You know, images, faces sort of appeared from the paint. And his way of dealing with that was to say, well, I've never been trained. I don't have any skill. How could this be happening? How could these amazing images be happening to me? And so he thought that there was a power outside himself that was directing it. He thought it was God or Jesus or angels. And so he made a pact with God that he would continue to paint while Joyce was alive. So the paintings were a way of celebrating their love, the love of his family, the love of his country, and his love of God. And while Joyce was alive, Stan painted, and he filled the house. He filled all the walls and the ceilings and everything.
Well, Ted Snell, your book, Facing the Stars, has these wonderful photos of Stan at home with all of his artwork. And it's like a house museum. The walls are overflowing. There's sort of almost installations everywhere. There's stuffed toys. There's stamps and photos affixed to paintings. It's a whole kind of, it must be quite an overwhelming experience to go visit Stan at his home.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And one of the reasons we had in the exhibition, which opened last night at the Lawrence Wilson Art Gallery, we put one of those large panos at about 7 metres by 2.5 metres across one wall so that people will get a sense of what they're like all jumbled together. Because taking them out and putting them on the wall, you go, oh, well, that's an interesting artwork. But when you see them all together, it is this fantastic cacophony of ideas and images and colours.
Can you describe one or two works for us, Ted? Choose some of the works that you think are particularly interesting and give the listener a sense of what they look like.
Well, look, I'd love to. And it's really interesting you played Carl Smith before, because there was a man who was talking about his love and talking about it through, you know, the supermarket checkout and whatever. And Stan did the same. Stan would take an object, you know, objects from his life, and he would make art out of them, which really answered the very big questions. I mean, there's a wonderful one of the ones that I think first attracted my attention was his painting of the birth of Christ, the miracle of the birth of Christ. Now you'd think, okay, well, that's been painted for centuries. You know, artists have painted Christ, you know, in his mother's arms, swathed in, you know, swaddling clothes and in a barn somewhere. Oh, no, not Stan. Stan
this
Stan
is more
decided
the obstetrician's viewpoint of the birth
this
of
is
Christ.
Definitely the obstetrician's view. You know, we see Mary laying on a thing with her legs wide apart and Christ appearing through the birth canal. And at the moment that he appears, this golden megaphone is attached to the game, celebrating to the world that he has arrived and he has come to save all the problems of the world. The afterbirth, or perhaps some water is at the bottom, there's a midwife attending, and all the angels in heaven around are celebrating this fact. You know, it is an incredible, remarkable image in every possible way.
Yeah, and as you say, I mean, perhaps it's the very inventiveness of those symbols, of the golden megaphone, of the fact that it's Christ coming out of the birth canal, is because Stan wasn't a part of Western art history. He had a whole freedom in his imagination, perhaps, that an artist who'd been brought up studying, you know, the Renaissance artist would think of, this is the way I should paint Christ. He has a whole different freedom.
Sarah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's what's so exciting about so-called outsider artists or artists who work on the margin. And Stan is definitely that. I mean, that term started as a way of describing artists working in institutions who were mentally ill or what. Certainly, I don't think Stan is that at all. He's not that. But he is an artist who is not kept burdened down by tradition. So he's able, to come up with a visual representation of something which is important to him, which is totally outside the canon of Western art. So he's able to just say, okay, if I'm going to paint the birth of Christ, what's important? Well, it's the moment where he appears, and we all know that the world has changed.
And as you sort of suggest there, Ted, I mean, this idea of outsider art, which, as you say, isn't quite the right term with Stan's work. I think you call it more visionary rather than outsider. It's something that seems to be very much of the moment in the art world. Venice Biennale this year has a real focus on work coming from these kinds of artists.
I can't tell you how excited I was when I walked into the main hall at the Venice Biennale and saw all of these so-called outsider artists.
You thought Stan could be here.
I actually did think Stan could be there, absolutely. And it was so interesting that, yes, we are at a moment, obviously, in the way in which we're looking at the history of art, where we're saying, well, where are the fresh images? Where are the ways of actually reinventing the visual world in which we live? And so often they've come from people who haven't had the burden of tradition. They've come with a completely fresh set of eyes, just like Stan.
I wonder if it says something too about a hunger for authenticity that might be a reaction against some of the sort of corporate commercial nature of the art world.
Oh, here to that. Absolutely. I mean, there is no way. Last night it was fantastic. People were walking around the exhibition with huge smiles on their face going, oh, I get it. I get it. And I get him. And Stan was there too in his wheelchair holding court. And everybody immediately realised this was the authentic thing. This was absolutely an artist or an individual who's trying to really make a connection to other people and to tell them what's important in their life.
Well, Ted Snow, it's a pleasure to hear about Stan Hopewell. Thanks for coming on Weekend Arts. And the book Stan Hopewell, Facing the Stars, is published by UWA. And as Ted was mentioning, there's an exhibition on at the moment in Perth at the Lawrence Wilson Art Gallery of Stan Hopewell's work. This is Weekend Arts on RN. When we continue after the news, contemporary Chinese poetry.
When it comes to power distribution, the focus of the past has been on building ever larger electricity grids. But with blackouts and power failures increasing, we're now seeing the development of microgrids. These miniature grids can stand alone or feed into the bigger network. So is the future of power hyper-distributed and hyper-connected? Find out on Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.